You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 205 by Rudolf Steiner, 13 lectures entitled The Human Being as Body and Soul in Relation to the Cosmos, translated by William Forward. This is Lecture 12, given on Dornach on the 16th of July, 1921. Yesterday I closed with a remark that in more recent times a confusion arose in relation to what the polarity of Ormuzd and Ahriman in the Persian view of the world actually is. I pointed out how we can go back to ancient European Germanic views as they are represented, for example, in the poem which has come to be known as the Muspili. It deals with the firmament and the earth in an entirely Christian way, expressing the opposing principles of Lucifer above and Ahriman below. I say entirely Christian, because it had not been infected by what has since been lost of the Muspili attitude of soul in respect of the above and below, for it was not at that time assumed that the Christian principle was assigned to the upper spirituality, but instead placed the Elias principle there, and it is Elias, then, who fights the Antichrist, his blood dripping downward as he does so. The Antichrist figure is a Christianized expression of the Ahrimanic principle. There was then still a clear consciousness, evident, in those ancient European Germanic ideas, that one had to distinguish between an upper principle and a lower principle, higher forces and lower forces, with the Christ principle holding the balance and harmonizing them. Once this Elias principle has been assigned to the upper realm and the anti-Christ principle to the lower, it will be easier to see how the upper principle is oriented toward a moral impulse to the world order and the Ahrimanic principle toward the intellectual impulse in the world's development. This sense of an above and below was seen as a polarity which is present in the world. It is also, in a way, projected onto the human being. We know that we determine what is above and below with reference to the main orientation of our spine, which is vertical. That is how we come to an above and below, a concept that is entirely relative. What we are considering today, quite apart from the above and below, is a polar opposition. The way in which this manifests in the human being is extremely complex. We can, however, also study this polar opposition as it appears more externally in the world around us. It is very useful to look at the world in a way that allows it to reveal the secrets at work within it by means of particular phenomena in which certain forces come to expression quite radically. There is a certain polarity expressed perhaps less clearly in us, but which can become very apparent once we take a comprehensive view of how we are formed. Like us, the bird family has emerged from the wholeness of the world order. What is more, the bird family reveals certain secrets at work in the world much more clearly than they appear at first glance in us, where their manifestation is altogether more complex. What is characteristic of the bird family? The main feature is that birds first appear before us, to the extent that they can do so in physical form, in the shape of an egg, from which they then emerge before the public at large, so to speak. Birds first make their appearance in the form of an egg. Then the egg has to be cracked open. The birds then begin their development outside the egg. And you will have seen how it is only once they have left the egg that their feathers begin to grow, etc. Now, this polarity of being enclosed within the egg and then continuing its existence outside with a coat of feathers is at first sight not so clearly expressed in us as human beings. We do not emerge into the world in the form of an egg, and we are spared from continuing our development in the world wearing a coat of feathers. But what is revealed to us by the bird family in terms of the egg shape and their subsequent appearance? Looking at the egg quite externally, it is naturally the calcareous shell that stands out. This calcareous shell has a certain form. Nevertheless, it cannot be considered essential to a bird's existence, since it is allowed to fall away. It is not an essential part of a bird. Putting it trivially, one could call it a protective sheath around the young creature. Whatever we might call it, there is nothing localized within the calcareous shell that works on into the form of a bird. What we have, then, is this secretion of matter in the outer shell. It is, as it were, ejected by the bird's organization like something that has been shed, which is no longer required for its later development. It is therefore thrown out. There must then be forces at work within the bird that secrete and later dispose of what constitutes the shell. Looking at the phenomenon in this way, natural laws at work on the earth will not help us understand what is going on. We will have to look at what is said in title Occult Science for an explanation. There is an indication there that at a certain stage in the development of our earth, the moon was secreted by the earth. Its matter was secreted by the earth. What we have been looking at is an imitation of this process. Just as the formative forces of the whole earth's cosmos once secreted the moon forces, the substance of the bird secretes the calcareous shell as something, let's say, super mineral. What was it then that initially lay within the calcareous shell? And there's a diagram. What lay within it was at first protected by the shell from the forces at work in the earth's surroundings. If the chick had been exposed to these forces too early, let us say to the sun's rays, it would, of course, have died. It could not have withstood the forces at work within the earth's surroundings. The fact is that the creature that is being protected by the calcareous shell is living in a world that is not really of the earth. What kind of a world is it then living in? It is the world that we ourselves have evolved through via Saturn, Sun, and the Moon, and which has ceased to exist. It is no longer present as a developing process on the earth. It is an element of the past that is still there in the present. If we then say that everything that is outside the eggshell belongs to the earth, then what is inside the eggshell is essentially what does not belong to the earth. It does not want to have anything to do with the earth itself. In a sense, it does not want to participate in the earth's development. It must first mature, then break through the shell to be ready for development on the earth. This is where we can introduce a further aspect. Not all creatures that start out in the form of an egg are actually born. A number of birds' eggs are destroyed, not to mention fish eggs and others. Moreover, and I don't know if it is always suitable to put these things out there so dryly, since there is so much that people prefer not to be made aware of, but in view of what lies ahead of us, there are things that we simply have to know and can no longer close our minds to. Moreover, a large number of birds' eggs are lost because we eat them. They do not come to fruition. Now the question arises, what is going on with all these eggs that do not mature into fully grown chickens, other birds, or fish? The common materialistic response might be, quote, well, that is nature at work, irrationally producing an overabundance at random, and so much of what nature produces simply goes to waste, close quote. That is, however, not correct. the essential substances that are somehow contained within the eggshell do not mature for earthly existence, but the forces that work in them are ripe for pre-earthly existence, the existence that we, as beings of the earth, went through during our Saturn, Sun, and Moon epochs. That is the luciferic state of being. They become substances from which luciferic existence continues to draw nourishment. Everything that is destroyed in the egg state gives nourishment to certain spiritual beings. Now, we shall turn our attention to what concerns the earth. Looking at the bird family, we first of all have the luciferic element contained in the egg, the aspect that does not wish to have anything to do with the earth, that does not wish to be on the earth, and so surrounds itself with a wall against the laws of the earth, which can only come into play when the warmth and light that are otherwise at work on the earth have broken the shell. What triggers this process? The opposite forces. If you place a bird's egg in front of you, you could say, inside it is in essence Lucifer. If you plucked all the feathers off a bird, you could say, here I have the purest image of the directing forces of Ahriman. These are Ahrimanic forces at work, even in the delicate downy feathers found on the emerging chick. Ahrimanic forces have already been able to exert their influence through the shell. They were in combat with what was totally against carrying feathers. Thus, when you look at a bird's coat of feathers, you have in front of you the purest image of Ahriman at work. Taking this further, you could say, quote, if I look at an egg, I see Lucifer in disguise, close quote. Lucifer's disguise is merely the outer form of the material secreted by him, as it were. Whether it is an eggshell or a snake skin that is shed, they are shed by the luciferic principle, the luciferic forces at work. These cast-offs can also reveal something of the gesture of luciferic forces at work. In their purest form, they manifest in spirals. On the other hand, the coat of feathers or any other natural phenomenon that inserts itself into the physical body from the outside reveals the Ahrimanic principle. The direction of that gesture is tangential. Take a peacock's tail feather, look at it carefully, and consider this. It is the purest image of the trajectory of Ahrimanic forces. We must, of course, be clear that Lucifer and Ahriman are interweaving and intermingling everywhere, and that we, therefore, only have images to go by. These are, however, most beautifully displayed in the bird family. We need only look at examples in the way I have described. The forces at work inside the eggshell are also at work in the bird itself. So the bird has the forces from the eggshell within it, and coming in from all around, the Ahrimanic forces. In the example of the bird, we also have the opportunity of clearly localizing both the etheric and the physical aspects. If you consider what a bird keeps of the luciferic forces that were inside the egg, the growth potential, you will find the basis of the etheric body. These are shown in red on my sketch. What a bird inherits from the egg constitutes its life forces, its etheric. Conversely, the mantle of feathers it adopts is under the sway of physical forces. What lies between them in the form of flesh, muscles, and so on, is influenced throughout the course of its life by astral forces. Birds, as examples, thus enable us to localize the astral forces in the flesh and muscles, the physical in their feathers, and the etheric in the growth forces inherited from the contents of the egg. It is much more complicated in the case of human beings. We do not manifest outwardly in the form of an egg. The luciferic qualities that the egg projects outwardly we develop in the womb. That is also the reason why Ahriman does not yet have an influence on us in the womb. Birds can show us how they carry the luciferic influence out in the world without it going astray, and also how they take on the Ahrimanic influence there. Individual details of this are apparent in us with particular clarity. We can then place the family of mammals between birds and human beings. One distinction in particular stands out between human beings and birds. Look at a bird's legs. Compared with human legs, they are generally pretty stunted organs. Why might that be? Look at a sparrow's legs. What pathetic little sticks they are next to our own proud legs. You might argue that the whole rather bony form of a bird is due to the fact that it is designed for flying, for taking to the air, hence the lightweight legs. It is as if they are mere indications of its connection with the earth. We, on the other hand, do not lift our legs off the earth, neither can we fly. Our legs stand like proud pillars on the earth. As such, they are a gift of the earth. Birds do not receive this gift, since they are not tied to the earth in the same way. They are somehow separated off from the earth. Bearing this gift from the earth, a human being is also more tied to the earth and to Ahrimanic forces than a bird. A bird does not receive its Ahrimanic forces so directly from the earth as we do. Ahriman shoots and sprouts into us through our legs, and from there into every other aspect of our organism. In birds, you will only find Ahriman shooting in through their feathers. Turning back to ourselves and the way we relate more to the earth through our legs, you might ask, why do we not have feathers? The reason is that we are not built for the earth in the way birds are. If we were to fly around in the air, we would also have feathers, since the Ahrimanic forces would work up into us from a quite different direction. As it is, we have only a hint of Ahrimanic forces working on us, evidenced by our hair. That is the extent of the Ahrimanic tendencies that we have. They are at their strongest in the human head. Our head has a great deal about it that is Ahrimanic, as we have seen elsewhere in our studies. When we look at mammals, we come to the view that they are even more closely tied up with the earth than we are. They are also bound to the earth in a way that we are not, namely through their forefeet, for example. Apes only rarely walk upright, and even dogs can do that when they are begging. But it does not lie in their nature. It is not even natural for gorillas to walk upright, since they are essentially climbers. Their forearms are for grasping and moving along with. Human beings, on the other hand, are halfway lifted from the earth. Birds are completely lifted above the earth, and mammals are bound to the earth with those forelegs and hind legs. They are, in a sense, entirely creatures of the earth. We have liberated ourselves from the earth by our upright posture and the orientation of our spine, where mammals are completely bound to the earth. The rest of a mammal's form also exemplifies this. Where a bird's feathers come from is where the mammal's coat of fur comes from, built into the organism from the outside, as it were. Taking all this into consideration, one will be able to arrive at the form of a mammal, bird, or a human being, or indeed other living creatures, from an understanding of their relationship to the earth. One can use this understanding to construe the form a creature will take. One could say that birds embody the luciferic principle, which abhors the earth, and so separate themselves from the earth as long as possible inside their eggs. They can thus ensure that the earth has the least possible influence on them. Their legs remain stunted, and the forces nearest to the earth, but above the earth, constituting its mantle of warmth, are those that influence birds more. They thus have the form that they do, stunted legs and so on. We, on the other hand, are bound to the earth by our lower limbs and can liberate ourselves from it in our upper limbs. Mammals are firmly embedded in the earth, standing on it with the four pillars of their legs and taking their form from out of the earth. It is primarily the forces working out of the earth that give mammals their shape. Such things were known to an older, more instinctive understanding of the world. This meant that the human head could be seen as a bird, as an eagle, because our head is shaped most independently of the earth and is really only a metamorphosis of our previous earth life. By contrast, our metabolic and lymph system, which is completely oriented toward the earth, could be seen by this earlier form of understanding as an ox, or a bull, or a cow, because this animal is likewise organized so as to be completely oriented toward the earth. The middle part of the human being, which acts as a kind of bridge between the eagle and the cow, was seen as a part which releases itself a little from the earth precisely by means of its metabolism. You might see how this manifests in the fact that a lion has a very short intestine. Its metabolism is extraordinarily basic, whilst by contrast its chest and heart systems are particularly well developed. Hence also its passion, its fury, and so on. The earlier way of understanding such phenomena saw the lion in the middle part of the human being. Now, we shall have to return to such perspectives in a more conscious way. We must be clear, for example, that we human beings differ from all animals in that we have an eye, capital. For the vast majority of people, this eye is still largely a dormant organ. To believe that our eye is very strongly awake is to be mistaken. As I have explained earlier, we are asleep in our will, and when our eye exerts its will, we relate to its activity much as we do to the night. Although the night is dark, we count on its being there in our lives. If you truly look back over your life, you will see that it consists not only of what is clear as day, but also of all the nights. These nights are somehow always cancelled out of our perception of the passage of time. The same is true of our eye. In terms of our ordinary consciousness, it is remarkable for its absence. It is in fact present, but not in our consciousness. Something is missing there, and that is how we are aware of our eye. It really is as if one had a white painted wall, and one part of it had not been painted white. What we then see is black. That is also how it appears to our ordinary consciousness, as something that has been extinguished. The same holds good for our waking hours. Our eye is initially always asleep, but whilst asleep, it shines through our thoughts, ideas, and feelings, and is thus perceived in ordinary consciousness, or rather it is considered that we are aware of it. We can say, therefore, that our eye is not perceived directly to begin with. There is a prejudiced psychology that believes that this eye is located within the human being in the same place as our muscles, flesh, bones, and so on. If one took a broader view of the phenomena of life, one would soon become aware that it is not the case. It is difficult, however, to put the case for this to a wider audience. I tried it in 1911 in Bologna, where I gave a lecture to the Conference of Philosophers. No one has yet understood this lecture. I tried to show there what the nature of the eye really is. In reality, our eye is to be found in every perception that we have, in everything that makes an impression on us. My eye is not to be found in my flesh and bones, but in what I can perceive with my eyes. If you see a red flower somewhere, you will not be able to separate the red from the flower. neither in your I, capital, nor in the whole experience that you have when you devote your attention to the flower. All this is the basis of your I. Your I is connected with the content of your soul. The content of your soul, in turn, is spread out in all that is around you. This I is less even than the air within you, which you are just breathing in, less than the air that was previously in you. The I is connected with every perception, and in essence with all that is outside you. It is active within you because it sends into you the forces of what it is perceiving. Moreover, the I is also connected with something else. You need only walk, that is, to express your will forces. Your I accompanies this movement, participates in the movement. And whether you are creeping, running, hopping like a bird, twisting and turning, dancing or jumping, the I will accompany every movement. Whatever activity you willfully engage in will be accompanied by your I. There again, however, the I is not within you. Imagine it is carrying you along with it. If you are dancing a round dance, is that inside you? There would be no room inside you for that. How could there be? But your I is engaged with it. Your I is dancing along. So your I is present in your perceptions and in your movement. It is actually never within you in the true sense of the word, as for example your stomach is inside you, but is always outside you. It is just as much outside your head as it is outside your legs, except that it engages very strongly with your walking, with the movements that your legs are making. Your eye is really very strongly engaged with the movements your legs are making. This is less so with your head. In what other ways are our legs, or indeed any of our limbs and our metabolic system, different from our head? Our astral and etheric bodies are relatively independent of our head, which belongs mainly to our physical body. This head of ours, which is such an ancient fellow that he comes from a previous incarnation, is really the most totally uncompromising inhabitant of the earth. Our legs and our metabolic system, on the other hand, keep their physical aspect closely connected to the etheric and astral bodies. In short, our legs keep closely connected with the etheric and astral bodies, and only our eye is relatively free of our legs, only accompanying them when they are in movement. The same is true of our metabolic system. Our metabolic organs are essentially bound to our etheric and astral bodies. We could now go on to ask, in what ways does our head differ from our limbs and metabolism? Our etheric body, astral body, and I are all free of our head. Our metabolic and limb systems within our physical body leave only the I free, whereas the etheric and astral remain closely tied to the physical. They are not free of it. The following will make this clearer. Imagine that your etheric body or your astral body, which have the task of caring for your physical body, come up with the idea of treating your metabolic and limb systems in the same way that they do your head, that they wanted to be free of it. Let us say, for example, that the astral body belonging to your metabolic and limb system wanted to behave in the same way that its colleague is allowed to do in relation to your head. It is only another part of your astral body, which is why I use the word colleague. What would happen then? It would be counter to the way the human body is constructed. Our abdomen would be wanting to behave like our head. It would become apparent that what is characteristically healthy for our head makes our abdomen ill. It is characteristic of all abdominal illnesses that our abdomen takes on the configuration of our head. This can be illustrated by a particular case I described in a lecture in Stuttgart or Zurich of a carcinoma, which began to form in a part of the body where there should not normally be any sense organs directed inward. And suddenly the astral body started to want to develop sense organs. A carcinoma is essentially an ear or an eye, EYE, wishing to form in an inappropriate part of the body. It grows inward. An ear or an eye wants to develop there. Thus, when this astral or etheric body, belonging to the abdomen, wants to behave like its equivalent in the head, an illness of the abdomen results. The opposite is also true. If our head wants to live like our abdomen, one can see it initially in migrainous conditions, and wants to draw the etheric body or astral body into its business, the result is illness in the head. If it wants to draw in the etheric body, migrainous conditions follow. If it wants to draw in the astral body, then even worse conditions follow. These examples go to show how complicated our human nature is. It cannot be studied in the way today's trivial science does. It has to be studied in all of its complexities. One has to be able to see that our head cannot be like our abdomen, since if it were, it would only become ill. Thus, if, for example, the cerebrum begins to develop its metabolic processes too strongly, begins to secrete too much, then illnesses will be the result. These strong processes of secretion derive from the fact that our head is placing excessive demands on our etheric body. Similarly, the moment our abdomen is left to its own devices, that is, become more head-like and tends toward developing sense organs, illness will follow. In short, the human head has a free etheric body, a free astral body, and a free eye, capital. Our metabolic limb system has our etheric and astral bodies bound to it, and leaves only the eye free. The human being of the middle, the rhythmic human being, has its etheric bound in, but leaves the astral and eye free. Head, free etheric body, free astral body, free ego. Rhythmic human, bound etheric body, free astral body, free ego. Metabolism limbs human, bound etheric body, bound astral body, free ego. Here you have an overview of the human constitution from a perspective which is particularly important, because it gives you an impression of how the I stands in a free relationship to the whole human being, how it works into us from waking up to falling asleep, and always remains relatively free. You will also see how your eye is connected with your outer sense perceptions and with the movements you make, but does not actually completely unfold within your bodies. Where does the human eye live? Are we able somehow to see where the human eye lives? To some extent, we can already see it in what develops in birds' feathers. We do not have feathers, but our eye lives in the forces that are in our surroundings, and in the case of birds, these give direction to how they come by their feathers. That is where our eye lives externally. Moreover, there are ways in which we can see these directional forces even more clearly. In a bird's plumage, we see them somehow captured by the bird's body, but these forces also give direction to freely moving creatures. Insects. When you see insects buzzing about and grasp their movement imaginatively, you will have there before you an image of where your eye lives. Imagine insects buzzing about in your surroundings, beetles, flies, beautiful butterflies, ugly horseflies and bumblebees, all kinds of insects. Imagine all these things swirling about you in every direction. That is where you will find the outer manifestation of where your eye in fact lives. It is more than a mere picture when we say ugly thoughts live there like bumblebees and horseflies, but also beautiful thoughts like butterflies. Many a human thought will bite like a nasty fly, and so on. The difference is that the one is spiritual, the other physical. The human eye really does live in our surroundings. This has very important implications, and true knowledge and understanding of the world depends on us being able to correctly evaluate what it is that we see. We should not waffle on about the spirit in generalities, but be able to see in image form around us what we inwardly experience in a more abstract and spiritual form. Everything that exists in the spirit can also be seen as an image in the world around us. There is always a place where what exists in a purely spiritual form may be seen in the form of a picture. We simply have to be able to interpret what is contained in the picture correctly. Thus, when aramanic elements come into our eye, when our eye finds an image of itself in butterflies or birds' feathers outside us, that is, the directing forces within them, then our eye will acquire the capacity to develop all kinds of forms from within. We can inwardly construct a circle, an egg shape, a triangle. We can create a whole world from within ourselves. If we then research further into this, we will find these are the very forces that have been ejected by the Luciferic principle. I recently said that when mathematicians study space, they should consider the hen's egg in relation to the dimensions of space. Something very interesting would then emerge. The polarity we are considering is this. Our eye lives both in the forms that we can construct within the world in this way, and also in what is constructed out of the world itself. On the one hand, we live in what shields itself from the world within an eggshell, within the Luciferic element, and on the other we experience what inserts itself into the bird's body in the shape of feathers, and what flies around us in butterflies and insects in general as our eye, as we do in our sense perceptions and our participation in the movement of our limbs. Indeed, anyone who understands the wonderful diversity of the world of birds around us will also understand many things about the nature of the human soul in its relationship to the world. What a bird turns out toward the world in its plumage, what comes shimmering toward us from the birds, also streams into the sense perceptions of our eye as glimmering, iridescent, sparkling impressions from outside inward. This is how we have to try to grasp the world with the aid of images. Today's abstract science is only able to grasp a tiny proportion of the real world. The end of Lecture 12.